This is Long John once again with the party line. We're around from midnight to 5:30, six mornings during the week. And Hans Stefan Sanderson and Morris K. Jessup are now removing their coats. What do you expect, to battle this morning, then?
Well, if we don't get one, what are we here for?
Well, we're going to be talking this morning with four or five different people. Hans Stefan Sanderson is the editorial director of Fantastic Universe. We were talking about that publication the other morning because in the current edition, the August edition of Fantastic Universe, there are two very important articles for people who are interested in the flying saucer phenomenon. The first article is UFO, Friend or Foe, written by Ivan T. Sanderson. And Mr. Sanderson has been a guest of the party line. The other article is written by Lester Del Rey, entitled The Flying Saucer Myth. Both of these articles are certainly worthwhile reading because you'll get the opinions of two well-known men in the field. Definitely, Lester Del Rey does not buy the flying saucer story. Mr. Sanderson, well, he has an opinion, and I think that you should read the August edition of Fantastic Universe. It's available on your newsstands. This is not a commercial, but I know so many of you people are interested in the stories about flying saucers that you'll want to read this copy. Dated August, Fantastic Universe, and Hans Stefan Sanderson, one of my guests this evening, is the editorial director of that publication. Morris K. Jessup is with us, the author of the new book about flying saucers, The Expanding Case for the UFO. We'll also have Dan Fry with us and George Van Tassel. Mr. Fry is the gentleman that claims that he took a trip in a flying saucer from a desert spot on the White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico, took the trip in the flying saucers from that point to the city of New York and back in a period of 32 minutes. That's pretty fast. According to Mr. Fry, he doesn't feel that that's too fast. He feels that that can be accomplished by many people. And I understand this evening that they gave a lecture at the Diplomat Hotel. I stopped in for around 3 or 4 minutes, and I must say that there were quite a few people there. Is that right, George?
Well, John, the place probably could have held another 50 if they'd stood them up.
I don't know where. Possibly in the lobby downstairs.
Well, there was a balcony upstairs that still had a little standing room.
Still had a little...
Yeah.
Oh, you're greedy. You're greedy, believe me.
Yeah. I thought we were going to have a riot when Long John didn't show up. Apparently about two-thirds of the people there came about as much to see Long John as I did to see you, Van.
Well, very likely, because a show of hands in the audience when we asked him how many were there due to this broadcast, I would say 50%.
Well, 50 or maybe even two-thirds. There was an awful lot of hands.
But... when the court announced that Long John had been there and then left, well, they tore the place up.
They certainly did. The applause shook the place clear to the roof.
I wondered why there were police cars near
the... That was it.
Well, now that we've gone along with the jokes for the evening, men...
This isn't a joke,
This isn't a joke.
You just don't realize how well you're liked.
That's right.
That crowd wanted
Long John.
I think that's true.
You know, the way you say that, that can be taken two ways. That crowd wanted Long John.
You take it either way, friend. You just take it either way.
If you read some of my mail, you'll find that there are some people that want me, too.
I guess that's right. I get that kind of mail, too.
Well, how do you think the audience received the two stories tonight? Your story, George, and Dan Fry's?
Well, the same way they always receive it, with a knowing and an understanding of a simple subject explained simply.
Flying saucers
are considered
a simple subject?
Simple to the extent that if the science of their operation is known, it's much more simple and less complex than any mechanism we have.
Well, I think you're aware of the fact that I have talked to possibly 15 or 20 different people who profess to have a knowledge of the subject of flying saucers, and I possibly have spent some 100 hours on the subject, and I must admit that I still don't know how they operate or why they're coming here. And I'm still a little confused.
Well, John, your groove is this particular program, and you're doing an awful good job with it, and maybe you're not supposed to know.
I see. Well, then,
we can't all do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Anything else new?
you see, their basic science of religion and science and culture and social things are all established on the same principle.
Now, when you say they, you're referring to people who are living on other planets. Is
on
that
other
correct?
Planets or in space, completely free from planets.
Or living in space.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of them, do.
Indeed, John, the word they in flying saucer parlance is spelled with a capital T, and it's practically a technical word. When anybody in flying saucer fan or somebody who's been contacted uses the word they, if you'll notice, usually a special emphasis on the word. That means
well, there's another
people.
Phrase, too, that's used on the program by many of the people who feel that they have some knowledge of flying saucers, and the phrase is the people.
Or these people.
These people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. It's practically a proper name and spelled with the capital letter.
So if I say that a group of people, they went to the palace tonight, would that mean they're from outer space?
If you're talking to saucer fans, it might very well mean.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm learning.
Well, good.
Hans, what do you think about the flying saucers?
Well, I'm just interested. By the way, I'm Hans Henderson.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that you knew George Van Tassel.
Fantastic universe. I'm the famous nonviolent witness at the discussion some time back, you know. That affected you. I was struck by what you said just now because I don't know if you've seen our current issue.
You aren't going to plug that thing again.
Our current
now,
issue of a magazine which will be nameless. Please, Mr. Joseph.
I do.
I want you to write an article for us, you know, so.
I'm still debating that one.
In that, Ivan Sanderson, in his article in this unnamed magazine, refers to a possible alternative about the UFOs. This is something that the Air Force has missed if one considered, though it seems finally to have abandoned the idea. It is simply that some UFOs may themselves be alive. This is to say, they may be a life form equivalent to, but not specifically, either animal, vegetable, or virus that may dwell in the upper atmosphere of this or all planets, or live in space itself. When you were talking, therefore, about they, were you therefore suggesting that life forms that Ivan was referring to in his article?
No, I wasn't. But I have a particular contact that I have never discussed publicly, either in lectures or over the air, in which these particular people are not like us. However, they have many advantages over us. For one thing, they don't have to walk around like we do. They move by an act that we call levitation. And they don't have to turn when they go anywhere because of the shape. They're shaped like an electric light bulb. In fact, in the comic strips, they were once called a shmoo. The only difference is that they have 32 eyes and a ring completely around their head, and they don't have to turn to look either. They can see in all directions.
Are you
same
talking
time.
About people who come from another planet?
I'm talking about intelligent beings.
Intelligent.
Other than us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other than us.
Other than humans.
I don't really know whether we should class us with them or not, but nevertheless, these beings live in space. They are not subject to temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
Neither heat heat nor cold can touch them.
Mm-hmm.
They said that they have a field around their individual body that is sufficiently strong to repel or ward off any of our 30-caliber machine gun bullets, and that they can move in and out of their ships because they don't breathe air like we do, and they can move around in space. They don't require to breathe, and they don't have any legs for the simple reason that they levitate at all times.
You say that you spoke?
Yeah, I spoke directly with these people.
To these people? What language?
Well, in thought communication, John, there's only one language.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't a language of English or Chinese or whatever it may be. A thought is what it is, and it can't be anything else.
Did you see them?
Indirectly, yes. In a beam they projected, I saw them.
Was this at Giant Rock Airport?
Yes, this is at Giant Rock.
Underneath the rock?
Underneath the rock.
Hans? No, I'm glad Hans brought that up because in all the research I've done covering literature for thousands of years, this sort of thing crops up continually. Mm-hmm. There are always, if you read a few hours in almost any class of literature, you will come to references which cannot possibly be anything but beings of non-human form, discarnate intelligences or uncarnate intelligences. And I have to be careful with the word carnate because even that has become a technical term in some fields of research. But I'm very glad to have that subject brought up and get a little clarification on it. There's more than one kind of UFO, U-F-O, and as Ben pointed out, the use of the word flying saucer is extremely unfortunate because there are so many different types of entity or structure in space and in the sky that just classifying them as a major task at the present time. That's right, Ben.
UFO isn't even a proper title because they aren't unidentified. Even the Air Force has used UFO as unidentified flying objects, and yet they know what they are. So they're really identified flying objects.
They do?
Oh, definitely. They've got at least six of the ships that they have.
Where?
They were forced down due to mechanical failures, and at least six that we know of.
Who are they?
One time they were Wright Patterson Field. And now I believe they're all under private research in various companies around the country.
Mm-hmm. What happened to the pilots of the, or intelligence of piloting the
UFOs?
Well,
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know except the one that Frank Scully wrote about. The bodies were taken from it. They were all dead in the ship or outside of it.
Well, hasn't there been a suggestion or a rumor around, rather, that the Scully story has been proven to be a hoax?
No, it has never been proven to be a hoax, and neither has the data which Crewe printed about Cy Newton. I know Cy Newton personally, and I know Frank Scully personally. And the individual who was a freelance writer who wrote those articles was not speaking for Crewe magazine. He was speaking for himself, and he had a personal grudge which he was taking out because in his first effort to contact Scully and Newton on the subject, Newton knew that he was trying to get a hold of some of this material which Newton had. And so he pestered Cy, so finally Cy slipped him some phony, it wasn't phony, it was just aluminum stuff, which this man eventually found out was strictly earthly aircraft material. And of course he brought it out that Cy had perpetuated a hoax that this wasn't the material from the ship. Well, Cy knew what the guy was trying to do all along, and so he just helped him along by giving him the stuff.
Much as you apparently did on a more recent occasion.
Well, I didn't give out any material that I know of.
Well, in the sense that you also, I'm thinking of the HO incident.
Oh, well, that's...
Oh, pardon me, let me interrupt a moment.
Yes, Doc.
Mr. Sampson was on the program that morning that Jules St. Germain was here when he told us about the
H.O. Uh-huh.
Well, I didn't know if you were aware of the fact that Mr. Sampson was on the program that morning. Well, before we get into the discussion of the morning, here's a message from one of our sponsors out in Newark. We're talking this morning with Dan Fry and George Van Tassel. I'm Stephen Sanderson, the editorial director of Fantastic Universe, is with us. And just to remind you again, in the August edition, that's the current edition that's on your newsstand, there are two articles, two startling articles about flying saucers. One written by Ivan T. Sanderson, entitled UFO, Friend or Foe. The other written by Lester Del Rey, The Flying Saucer Myth. And we also have with us the author of many books on the subject of flying saucers, Morris K. Jessup, whose most recent book, The Expanding Case for the UFO, published by Citadel Press. Dan Fry, I know that you possibly have read some of the articles that have appeared in the various magazines, such as Fantastic Universe and other publications. How do you feel about these articles that have appeared about flying saucers?
Well, I have never had any criticism, John, about the opinion of the authors of these articles, because it's everyone's right to have their own opinion on any subject. And it is also their right to express that opinion within reason at any time and any place. The only criticism I would have of most of the articles that have appeared is that the individual who has written these articles, in most cases, has apparently spent almost no time or effort in determining the facts concerning the things about which he writes. I don't mean the factuality or non-factuality of the subject itself, but the little details of the individuals who are described. There have been articles in which I have been mentioned and Brian have been mentioned and others who have had experience have been mentioned, in which our names were incorrectly spelled, our ages were incorrectly given, our experiences were mixed up and turned up, and there are articles in which almost nothing stated in there as fact is actually fact.
In other words, you feel that they didn't do an adequate amount of research writing the article.
As far as the facts which could be determined readily, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You're referring mostly to articles of what you might call a negative nature. UFO and saucers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, do you think that there's anybody who could be considered to be a qualified expert on the subject of flying saucers?
Well, this would be merely a question of the definition of the term. What is an expert and what is a qualification?
Mm-hmm.
I think that anyone who wished to write an article on the subject could readily obtain the facts, that is the correct spelling of an individual's name, his correct age, his place of residence, and things like this, which are readily obtainable. And if these are put in correctly, then the individual is welcome to have any opinion on the subject which he chooses.
Well, how about the stories? Forgetting about the fact that possibly they have misspelled a name or possibly misquoted an age, do you think that they've been fair in their opinion of the people who claim that they have had physical contact with people from other planets?
Well, I don't see how in many of these cases, how the opinions could be fair or otherwise, because they simply have no basis on which to formulate an opinion. I have read a number of stories. One was in a men's magazine a year and a half ago, which began with a sneer at the credulity of people who would believe in this sort of thing, who would, as it was put, accept data without proof. The author then went on to give quite a long article in which there wasn't one single true statement. There wasn't one single statement of fact.
Do you remember some of the untrue statements?
Yes, I remember some as well. Let's put it this way. The article started out with a quotation of what I had said in a talk at the spacecraft convention. I had made no such statement. I had not even approached that particular subject in any way. The article began by describing this middle-aged rocket technician, Dan Fry, which is perfectly all right. I have no objection to people describing me as middle-aged, but the interesting thing was that in the next paragraph, this individual referred to Truman Bethlehem as the young road mechanic, who happens to Truman Bethlehem is 10 years older than I am. And this merely proved beyond all doubt that this writer of this article had never met either myself or Mr. Bethlehem, nor had he ever met anyone who had met either of us.
Is he a road mechanic?
He is a road mechanic, yes.
Well, do you think the difference in the age, the misquoting of the age, is of great importance to the story itself?
Well, it is an evidence that the individual who wrote it had no basis for making a determination or an opinion on one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't investigated the subject enough to be able to formulate an opinion.
Maybe he was judging by the picture on the back of the jacket. You know, Bethlehem looks rather young in the book.
The entire article was written in a vein of ridicule to begin with. I remember the article, and I was described as a high school graduate, which was, again, an error, and numerous things. I mean, it was so obvious that every sentence had an error in it of some kind. Due to the fact the man had never contacted any of the people or talked with the ones he was writing about. He evidently sat at his desk and dreamed all this up, and in the flying saucer game, why, of course, he would have been declared immediately as someone having hallucinations. But in the writing game, why, it was accepted because they can twist things around so badly anyway that it's normally accepted that way.
Have you read any of the articles that have appeared in the monthly publication that is put out by, published by CSI, Civilian Saucer Intelligence?
I don't know whether I've read any of the recent ones.
Mm-hmm. They make it a point not to send those bulletins to us, I guess, John, because they're anti-contact, I understand, and they don't believe anybody's had any contact, and so the people that have had contact don't get their literacy.
The most interesting thing about the thing that amuses me concerning these articles is that the writer almost always starts out, as I say, with a sneer at the credulity of these people who accept testimony without having proof. And then the individual proceeds to write an article that has not a word of truth in it and expects his readers to swallow it a whole without any proof. This is always amusing when you see this done.
Well, as an editor, pardon me, just one moment, Mark.
Go ahead.
As an editor, Hans, how do you feel about that?
You even look pained.
It works in me much as
when I say pained, I say this because, frankly, I'm rather sorry that you had such unpleasant experiences. I know that at least at Fantastic Universe, we have made every effort to be as accurate and as objective in our report as possible. For example, I'm sure you won't find anything wrong with the description of Truman Bethlehem as a journeyman engineer and a welder, which is based on his own book. And similarly, in other material, when we have had on occasion and some reason to mention anyone, we will have gone directly to sources.
Oh, well, we've got
the people.
As far as CSI,
well, this, in theory, we were not doing a science fiction article when you have an article on this contact cases and on people who claim to have had these experiences. I mean, you know, this is the article I'm referring to, so I wasn't aware that it was science fiction. But, you see, we share with CSI, and I must say this in a very gentle disagreement with you, an attempt, at least, to be rather objective. And I'm quite sure that you're mistaken, or that you're mistaken, or that you misunderstand.
Well, we
failure
really
to send your bulletin.
We were referring only to certain particular stories which were written, which we know were never researched because no one had ever contacted us or anyone that we knew of to get the information to us.
Let me give you an illustration of how I, for example, work. I am frankly, I don't deny that I am mildly skeptical of any
research.
By not only by both of you, but by some others who have appeared on John's program. But on the other hand, I would tell you exactly the same thing I told Howard Minter. Show me. And if you show me, I'll go as far along the way as I possibly can with you.
Mm-hmm.
But until you show me, or until you can document, not in the way that has been done up to now, but in a way that as a research worker,
I can personally, at least half accept, I would be willing to go along with you. In the meantime, I am forced as an editor responsible to my readers to rely on existing sources of material. In our case, it happens to be the organization you refer to, CSI, the Civilian Social Intelligence, whom I have found to be very sincere, very thorough, very analytical in their approach, and granted, a little critical at times of things which they feel are exaggerations, but they attempt to document any patient.
Well, their attempt to document the contact certainly weren't done, because nobody from CFI ever contacted me and ever asked any questions at all, and yet they definitely state and have stated that they figure all contact is strictly hoax.
That article of theirs, I think it was in the December 15 issue of their bulletin, wasn't it? They had a devoted barricade
in
the house.
Yes, they did.
They had a barricade in the house. I am expected to be here tonight, by the way. I mean, so that's why I didn't bring any ammunition with me. Otherwise, I could have brought it along and posted some passages to you.
I read one article in which they wrote up me in particular, and I talked about my hallucinations and so forth, and yet none of them had ever contacted me to find out what I was like or what my experience was directly or anything else.
Hallucinations? I don't remember.
Well, it wasn't just that word, but I don't know what word they did use, but it was strictly a detrimental article in its entirety, implying that I just was a pipe dreamer or something like that. The entire article was based on that. And I don't know how they consider it to be investigators or intelligent when they write an article about a man they never talked to and know all about him.
I can gather from at least the article in the December issue that some of their people have talked to you.
No.
I would like to just add this into the conversation. I happen to know Ted Blocher personally, and a couple of the other members of CSI, and I've enjoyed having them on the program, but I've taken issue with them on the Howard Menzies case. Now, I can understand that they have a limited amount of money. They have to budget themselves, and I would say that it would be difficult to go all the way out to California to visit George Van Tassel or to visit with Dan Side. But I felt that at least they should have investigated the Howard Menzies story. And I don't think that they did that. Now, they may take issue with this statement.
I think they may.
Well, they criticize the story.
Well, at least, John, they're always the U.S. mail. It doesn't cost much to be off the Coast Guard to put in on something that you're going to write about.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah. I'm a little inclined to take similar view to him on the being at least mildly skeptical in some of these cases, but that we have to distinguish between two types of what you might call negative articles. The thing that Dan Fry started out talking about a while ago was an article written by what you might call a professional debunker. A debunker has to debunk or he hasn't got any occupation. And if he keeps it up, he does run into the situation where he doesn't have legitimate or at least accurate information to do it with. Now, I don't think the CSI boys are in quite the same category as professional debunkers. I think the biggest trouble was that Lex Mebane and Ted Blocher, both of whom I know and consider very good friends, the basic trouble with them is simply youthful enthusiasm. They get off on one of these things and write it a little harder than they are justified in doing on the basis, as Dan points out, of the factual knowledge they have in hand. There are times when I'm inclined to agree with them, but I'm not going to make the radical statements. In any case, it's my privilege to agree or not to agree, but it's my privilege to make unwarranted and unfounded statements.
Well, as I pointed out, I have no objection whatever to any conclusion that anyone arrives at, provided that that conclusion is based on a reasonable amount of research to begin with or investigation. As you say, there are some people who are called professional scoffers who make a living by smearing the things that they know nothing about. It doesn't matter whether they know anything about them or not, because their only good job is to smear and...
There's another thing which hasn't occurred to a lot of people in regard to contact stories. That is that these stories can be proved, but they cannot be disproved. When a man says he saw something, you cannot possibly prove that he didn't do it, but he may be in a position to prove that he did. And if you weren't there at the time, it's a little dangerous to say that it is definitely untrue.
Well, have you ever met anybody, Morris Jessup, that has claimed that they've had a physical contact or a number of physical contacts with people from other planets and that they've been able to offer you any proof?
I don't think anybody has ever offered me anything that I could call proof. Of course, I haven't made any serious attempts to find the proof either.
Well, you've talked with a lot of these people,
I've talked to just a few, three or four. And
you've talked to Howard.
I've talked to Dan, George Van Tassel. That's right. And one or two other people. Frankly, I haven't yet been confronted with anything which I consider ironclad proof. But circumstantial evidence. I've had no proof except an overwhelming mass of personal reports, or what you might call eyewitness evidence. And you either accept it or you call the people liars outright. You have to do, almost have to do one or the other if you express an opinion. Mm-hmm. And so far, I haven't felt that I was qualified to express a definite opinion one way or the other. I am not convinced of the accuracy of the statements. I don't question anybody's good intention or integrity in this matter. I do question the accuracy of a good deal as I have been told. But I have no proof negatively or positively, and I certainly am not going out on the limb as, perhaps CSI does, in stating flatly that what somebody says he did is not true. I can't prove it, and I'm not going to make myself too liable to.
Well, I think we ought to look into this term proof a little bit. We hear this word used a lot. John, what would you consider proof?
Well, you put me on the spot. You must have been listening to some of the programs, because I brought this point up myself. What would be proof? In other words, if you brought me a publication here, and you told me that this was a magazine that's printed on the planet Mars, I don't know what I could say about it. I'd have to say once again, well, I don't buy it. If you brought me a piece of metal, if you brought me a piece of fabric or anything, very frankly, this would not prove anything to me. I'll have to admit that to you. I would say that proof would be to me... just talking off the cuff, I would say that possibly actually seeing a saucer land, not having somebody point up in the sky and say, do you see that? And possibly I do see something up there, and I don't know what it is, and whoever's pointing it out to me would say, well, John, that's a saucer. Well, this would be difficult for me to buy. Another bit of proof would be possibly to witness some of these telepathic communications. Also, another... Well, no, I was going to say, meeting some of the people. This wouldn't prove anything to me either, because we've been told by Howard Menger that they look like Earth people. So, what would I know?
Right there, I would like to know how you would witness a telepathic communication. If you can explain that one to me, we might be well on the way.
Yes, I can. I have been told by some people on the program who will remain nameless at the present time because we will not discuss them, that they can be sitting in their home, in the room in their home, and when they do receive a telepathic communication, it is audible to other people sitting in the room. So if that is so, why can't I hear it?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
in other words, John, you mean if you heard it, then this would be proof.
To me?
Yeah.
I agree with you that it wouldn't be proof to possibly many people who may listen to the program.
Yeah, that's
it would be proof of at least a message. However, I also do know, because I have a little knowledge of magic and a little knowledge of pseudo-mind reading, that I would be able to do this for you. But if I witness this phenomenon, then, in turn, I would like to investigate the room.
But John, one thing is this. Assuming that you, let us say right now, hear such a necklace, what proof do you have of the extraterrestrial origin of that necklace?
That is very true. I would say this, that if I had the opportunity to investigate, to look over the house, the room, wherever I may be, and if I didn't find any mechanical or electronic equipment there, then I would be led to believe that something is happening that I cannot understand. So therefore, I would say, well, possibly this may be one of these telepathic communications. And when I say that, I don't mean to infer that I'm a genius when it comes to magic or pseudo-mind reading. No, I am not. But I have a little more knowledge than, let's say, the average girl on the street.
Yeah. When you say it may be, you certainly are not claiming it's proof.
No. That's right. It boils down to the fact that all of this material is evidence. There is no such thing as absolute proof. And if you want to carry this to its logical conclusion, you can show that there is no such thing as absolute proof of anything.
Well, would you consider, John, in 1952, I notified the Air Force that the saucers were going to buzz Washington before they buzzed it by registered air mail letter with a return receipt that they signed. And the event happened exactly as I told them it was going to happen. They were buzzed in Washington. The radar...
You told us that the other morning, yes.
...have shown that and so forth, and many witnesses can testify.
May I just say this to answer that question? And I'm not trying to imply that I don't have confidence in you as an individual as being an honest, sincere person. The fact that you have a receipt from a registered letter that proves that they did receive a registered letter in the Pentagon or the president, whoever you addressed it to, does not necessarily prove to me the content of that letter. Okay. You may have sent a birthday card saying, "Happy birthday, President."
You know, I foresaw a guy like you coming along.
That's right.
So I also sent
this
a copy.
Is not personal,
no. I just foresaw a character like you in the future. So I also sent a exact copy of the same information to the Los Angeles Examiner and the Life magazine at the same time. They also received copies of that letter.
Have they ever acknowledged that letter?
Not other than signing the return receipt.
Well, now, at this point, I must say
I
have no reason to doubt it. It would seem to me that life was a little lax, and also the Hearst paper out in Los Angeles was a little lax in not following this up. I think that this should make front-page headlines.
Yeah, but you see, when something says suppress, they suppress. They don't follow anything up. It's under suppression.
In other words, you're implying that the United States government has suggested to the editors of Life and to the editors of the Los Angeles Examiner that they should not...
I'm not suggesting who did anything, John. I'm just suggesting it's being done.
A little grain.
I know editors myself who told me personally they have been told not to print it.
Well, I don't want to go in and be... I don't want to be repetitious
what
about
I'm
a discussion
at
we
is
had
they...
the other month. Why don't they tell me to stop?
Well, there may be a purpose in it now that there wasn't then. There may be a reason.
Whose purpose?
There may be a purpose in having you bring out all these various things for their information.
But did they already know it?
I know top engineers in the aviation field who came to my place regular hoping to find out something about the method by which they could control something by thought, which led me to believe that they were connected with research that might be conducted on these saucers, which are thought controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they didn't know how to control them. And I readily agreed to help them in any way I could, and in fact I did. I told them exactly what to do and how to do it, but they still don't know how to do it because they have no knowledge of thought communication. I'd have to give them a 2-year course in how to to work with thought.
Can you teach somebody?
Certainly, anybody can learn.
Anybody can learn.
That's right.
If they're not telepathic
anybody?
Yes, definitely.
Anybody? Anybody. Well, I can take a person that had been in the asylum 25 years or something like that. No.
Would say the average person or many people. Anyway.
The average
you
person.
Mean that the person doesn't require what's called psychic ability?
No,
or,
there's no
ESP.
Such thing as psychic ability connected with it.
Mm-hmm.
Psychic ability is an intuitive thing. That's something you get by first. Or like hunches, you can call them hunches. And the thought is communication process is a mechanical means of doing something. I mean, there are steps in which you can take. This is just the same as the ignition or timing of an automobile.
Last night, I heard Dan Fry speak of this several times as being, I believe, an electronic process. Is that right, Dan?
Well, I say that it could be demonstrated electronically. It could be duplicated
electronically. More parallel rather than...
Yes, I was attempting to make the process understandable to persons who have studied electronics and haven't studied much anything. Now, it can be demonstrated electronically. You can produce a device to do it.
Well, now, let's get back to this word proof again. Yeah. As Dan said a while ago, under certain circumstances, it can almost be impossible to prove anything. I disagree with that a little bit, because I believe you can always carry knowledge back to a point where it is provable. For instance, I believe we would all agree that we are here on the Earth, and that is provable in some place between that kind of a statement and some of the right things that we maybe call it a serious time is a true situation. But this matter of what constitutes proof about a flying saucer or a spacecraft or a UFO intrigues me, because I have never yet been able to dream up any circumstance, situation, or object which would actually constitute proof, say, in a court of law or before a jury of scientists. Dan, have you got any idea?
Well, this is a question. Question of cumulative evidence. This question was once brought up, you remember, to the ex-head of the Royal Air Force. He was asked if he believed in saucers, and he said, "Yes, I believe that they're real." And he was asked if he'd ever seen one. And he says, "No, I've never seen one." And he says, "I've never seen Australia either, but I believe that it exists." And we can take that as a good starting point. I might ask everyone here if they believe that the continent of Australia exists. Most of us would say that we do. But if you try to prove, by material proof, that continent exists, you're going to have an awful tough job.
Well, I see your point.
You can amass a tremendous amount of evidence, but no one piece of that evidence is going to be proof, because every bit of it could have been faked, every bit of it could have been arranged, every bit of it could have been manipulated.
That's exactly
you have
right.
To have a mass of cumulative evidence is the only thing that constitutes true proof.
In my book, I've taken the attitude that while no single piece of evidence for flying saucers that I have presented might stand on its own feet, that when you have enough indications, it's tantamount to being proof. And when you come right down to it, you cannot possibly prove that the sun is going to rise tomorrow morning. It has been doing it for millions of years, but it may not do it tomorrow morning. Of course, we won't be here either. But, all right, Hans, what have you got?
Can I, Mr. Lancaster, when you talk to your people in California, how do you go about proving these things?
Well, I had a crippled boy and his wife come into my place one day, and he told me he came in to discuss flying saucers.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, why do you want to discuss flying saucers? Have you ever seen one?" And he said, "No, I never have." I said, "Well, why do you believe there are such things?" And he said, "Well, I believe in God, and I never saw him either."
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of an answer are you going to give a person when they answer you like that?
Yeah.
Belief is something similar to faith, only belief is actually taken from the word belie, which means counterfeit. Belief is a counterfeit faith. That's what it amounts to. But it cannot be detected from the real faith.
But in your college, the University of Wisconsin, is it Institute for
Parapsychology?
Parapsychological research?
No, it is.
How do you go about...
Let him answer the question first. You asked the question.
We probably have... we are probably the only group that I know of in the United States that you could call saucer-minded or saucer researchers that are actually doing something about it. We're not still trying to find out if these things are or publish sightings. I never publish sightings. We are trying to do something with the evidence we already have.
Some of us who are very much interested in this field find a little confusing if the apparent need for almost theoretical trappings in order to bring across this message from the people in capital letters to lay people. Why is there need for this?
There wouldn't be any.
Why is there need for this mystical, if you'll forgive me for saying so, which is something so peculiar to the air out in California? Because if you are the vehicle through which wisdom is to be brought to us, this some of this rather curious paraphernalia completely necessary.
Well, you see, like Dan said, we are not trying to sell anybody anything. We don't care whether anybody believes in flying saucers or not. And in fact, I've disproved more of them than I've proven to people that have come out to my place who want to believe in flying saucers. This thing, there was no reason for this in the first place. No reason for all this controversy or skepticism or anything else. If the government agencies that investigated this thing had openly investigated it. But like everything else, where the ego predominates, certain officials decided this must be kept under security. So, despite the fact, well, certainly they knew every other government knew as much about it as they did. They're not keeping anything from another nation.
Every other
government on the face of the earth knows as much about flying saucers as this government does. These things are all over the world. They're not just...
does that mean that they do know anything about them? Say they know
definitely
as much as any other government.
That for years. I can't say any stronger. They know what they are. They know how
and
they
know as much as you do about them.
They don't know a few of the things that I know, but then on the other hand, I don't know some of the things they know.
Do they really believe that there are people landing here in flying saucers from other planets?
Well, I talked to two brain surgeons. We postmortemed the brains of 16 bodies. Now, certainly if the Air Force called in civilian brain surgeons to examine brains, they must know the flying saucers existed that the
brain
bodies were taken.
Of who? Who are these 16 people? Of space people?
Yes, definitely.
Identifiable as such?
Well, they identified them by the fact that the fiber of the brain indicated they were from 300 to 700 years old, according to our own scale of chart under a microscope. That was not only...
there we run right back into the same old definition, or lack of definition of what constitutes proof. You have been told by two brain surgeons that they did this thing, and thus and so was the evidence and the opinion, and you have to take that on their say-so, just as everybody else has to take your statement, or Mendes' statement, or Dempsey's statement, as to contact.
That's right, but as I say, if this hadn't been started under a security measure, as something happening to the world rather than to a nation. You see, if something is happening to a nation, then I believe it is privileged to withhold this information from other nations if they feel that it is definitely for their own security.
Do you know the name of these brain surgeons?
No, I don't, John.
Is this name available?
No, they're not available.
Didn't say you talked to them?
I talked to them, yes.
And you don't know their names?
At the time, I was not concerned with their names.
Supposing I
came up to
you...
They introduced themselves, and they gave their names. My wife talked to them. I have witnesses that talked to them.
And they gave their names?
They gave their names, and they talked to us for 2 hours, and I have witnesses to the fact that they said what I just got to say.
Supposing you didn't know me, and I walked into your place out at Giant Rock Airport.
Yeah.
And I said, my name is Joe Blow. I'm a brain surgeon. Would you believe that?
I would believe it if you talked in terms of brain surgery that made sense to my reason, yes.
Supposing I had a little medical background, 2 or 3 years of medicine.
Okay.
Possibly I would have some...
In other words, you're trying... You see, when anybody tries to offer you proof, John, that's your failure right there. Because when I try to offer you proof... You reject it on the basis of
I'm
fact that it's only
the I'm open
see?
For it.
Yeah.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York. This is Long John with the Party Line, 710 on your dial. Now, once again with the Party Line, my guest this morning, George Van Tassel. Dan Fry is the man that claims that he was in a flying saucer. Took a trip from the White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico to New York and back in a period of 32 minutes. Hans Stefan Sanderson is with us this morning, the editorial director of Fantastic Universe. And I'd like to remind you people on the Party Line who are interested in flying saucers that the current edition of Fantastic Universe, dated August, it's on sale at your newsstand, has 2 excellent articles about flying saucers. It'll give you both sides of the flying saucer question. The one article is written by Ivan Sanderson, who's been a guest on the program many times. It's entitled UFO, Friend or Foe. The other article is written by Lester Del Rey. It's entitled The Flying Saucer Myth. We also have with us another author of many flying saucer books, Morse K. Jessup. And his most recent book is The Expanding Case for the UFOs. I'd like to get back, George, to that discussion that we were in at the time that we had to do a little business. I have to make a buck once in a while, you know. It seems to me that you made the statement that I was not willing to accept proof when it's given to me. Is that right?
Well, I told you something had happened, John, and because I couldn't offer you the names of these two men, at the time they told me this thing, I wasn't interested in saucer research. We were conducting the research on something entirely different that had nothing to do with flying saucers.
Is this prior to the time that you had received telepathic communications from other planets?
No, but I wasn't interested in the saucers as a researcher. In other words, I was. We were having experience and doing certain things ourselves, but we didn't know that this was something that whole groups would be doing or that controversies would arise over or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
To us at the time, it was just a little incident to take place every day, as real as anything else, and... nothing to especially question people about or keep a record of everybody you talk to that comes on the place. We run a public airport and see 300 to 500 people a week, and we can't write down every conversation we have.
Well, did these two doctors arrive at your airport in a plane?
No, they drove in.
Well, certainly this must have been a very exciting day for you when two brain surgeons arrive at your airport and they're going to tell you about 16 operations that they perform.
Well, contrary to being exciting, it was very dull because I had so much information prior to that was only just further evidence in my book.
On that? Information on that?
That was just further evidence.
I thought you weren't interested at the time in this field.
Well, I wasn't interested to the extent that I wanted to write down their names or keep a record of anything that they said. I had witnesses that they said it. That should have been sufficient. for any purpose, right, and had no idea of ever discussing it over the air or publishing or anything else.
No, I can understand that.
This controversy seems to hinge on the fact that no names were given. I don't see where the proof would be any more complete if names had been given.
The names were given.
If you had the names, supposing you could call two names tonight. What additional proof would that entail?
Well, I think it would prove this. In other words, if you mentioned the names of two great brain surgeons, possibly I wouldn't recognize their names, but no doubt some of our listeners. We have many doctors that listen to the program, and they possibly would want to talk to these two brain surgeons and get some of this information. I think it's very exciting.
Well,
myself.
There's no doubt, but when they were called in under security.
Mm-hmm. But they did divulge this
information. Yeah, because I think they figured we were out in the middle of nowhere and we knew about this thing, and they came and discussed with me because they had to get something off their chest to somebody.
Uh-huh.
That's the attitude.
So you feel they picked you more or less at random?
We have many prominent people come to us and discuss this subject because they feel that they can unload some burden they're carrying, that some strange experience has happened to them.
Well, did they have a strange experience?
No.
In other words, had these two doctors, did they make the statement to you that they had also received telepathic communications or actually ever talked to a person from another planet?
No, but they did say that before they examined the brains, that the dentist had examined the teeth, and they talked to the dentist, and they said the dentist stated that in the 16 bodies there was no evidence of either decay or repair of the teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that naturally was startling to them, and it was quite startling to find out that they were running a post-mortem on brains of people from some other planet.
Maybe they've got fluoridated water on the other planet.
And chances are these two men were under security at the time, if not still. This word security, this thing that keeps things secret, is one of Satan's tools. It is the most vicious thing that can happen in a free country, because behind that curtain of security, the very forces that we are against, the evil, destructive forces that take over government, are operating.
But you don't know the half of it.
Well, I've maintained that this subject should be brought out behind security.
Well, we're trying to do that tonight.
It is not anything that concerns the defense of this nation.
I think we're all perfectly willing to help you bring that out.
I know in the Venuto case, I don't know the names of...
In the what?
Venuto.
In the Venuto case.
I'm not familiar with that.
Well, that's been often called the L.A. Times case, the Los Angeles Times case.
We call it
the Venuto case. I happen to be one of the first people that investigated that before it was officially investigated. And I got into it strictly. I know it wasn't an accident now, but I thought so at the time. Simply because I happened to be at the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And this man who had this Venusian contacting for a job with the Los Angeles Times had caused this man to feel that possibly he was becoming mentally unbalanced or something. The things that were taking place right in his presence were just not earthly possible. And so he, in turn, called a friend of his who was an occult scientist, I'll call him, because he did... administer occult science, and...
he's a minister... of occult science?
They don't call him a minister. I don't know what you...
Well,
him,
I mean, was he... was
he a practitioner or a...
Christian metaphysicist?
Metaphysician.
Was he an Indian?
No, he wasn't Indian.
Metaphysician?
Metaphysician.
Mm-hmm.
And after he heard the story from his friend, why, he in turn was a very close friend of Frank Scully. So he knew Frank was interested in saucers, so he called Frank and told him the story. Well, Frank in turn phoned another party whose house I happened to be at to get him to go investigate it, because this man did most of the investigation of all kinds of saucer contacts and stories. And so he and I together immediately made a luncheon appointment with this man in the L.A. Times case, who I'll call Mr. B. And we went and had lunch with him. He phoned and invited him to have lunch with us, and he was very reluctant at first to talk. But he told us all the things that had happened. In fact, his wife was beginning to think he was a little off the beam, but he had physical evidence, see? This man had done some things to a metal plate which no human can possibly do. And we got the metal plate and run an analysis on it.
What happened to the Venetian?
Well, as far as I know, he's still running around the streets and somewhere in this country. Because he came to my place 6 months after he quit down in Los Angeles. He didn't work for the Times. Actually, they didn't employ him. This man, Mr. B, referred him to a friend of his who worked for a Los Angeles County Defender's Office, an attorney. And in turn, he worked by the day for out of petty cash for the Los Angeles County Defender's Office.
In other words, so there's no documentary, there's no record of his employment.
There's a record.
If he was working and being paid per diem.
The physical evidence, he witnesses to the fact he worked there.
But if he's being paid per diem, there would be no,
He didn't have a means to identify himself by our system. That's why he made it a point of getting a job.
Couldn't that have been arranged?
Sure, he arranged it.
Couldn't
himself,
that have been arranged for him to get those identification?
I don't know how. Uh-huh. He would have to have a place of birth and so forth. And he'd only landed here up near Barstow, California, and he told these people he was in Venus, and he told the man in the L.A. Times office he was in Venus.
What did he look like?
Well, he looked like Earth people, except he had no appearance of a beard or whiskers, which they had said they whipped the shaving problem a long time ago, so... he had no appearance of whiskers or anything like that.
I'm happy I haven't got a razor blade sponsor tonight, but go ahead.
he was approximately the same height as our people, and he did phenomenal things in the time he was employed there for the 5 weeks he was with the...
Well, were those phenomenal things, physical things?
Yeah, they were
completely
physical.
Or do you think he used other forces that... you and I don't...
Well, because he traveled. They gave him a list of names that would normally require days of automobile or our surface transportation to get around these places. They were scattered all over Southern California. And he completed the whole round in 5 hours, which for the distances covered to get to all these addresses, where all of them said he walked up the door and they signed the... writ or whatever he presented them with. This particular phenomenal thing of speed was one thing. It, of course, this same thing happened back in the Greek times, and they named the man Greek god Mercury because they pictured him with wings on his feet because he could get around. It's the same condition he used that Howard Menger described, these pulsating belts, these anti-gravity belts or gravity nullifying belts, where he could just step off the ground and take off, and he could be in Santa Ana and nothing flat. Apparently was, because the course he covered was approximately 300 miles. He completed it in 5 hours and got 20 signatures.
I don't mean to
that does well known to authorities. I know that because the authorities were called in to investigate.
I don't mean to express any doubt, of course, but you know, the gravity belt, for example, is an old timer in science fiction.
That's right. Well, science fiction, you know, they didn't get these ideas from nowhere. They already existed.
So is the submarine, George. So is the submarine all the time. It's one of the oldest timers in science fiction.
Well,
that doesn't mean that it can't
exist. Yes, of course, the submarine dates back from the old science fan, but I'm talking about more recent material.
Gravity belt in the Bible.
Work merely indicates that there is a certain lapse of time between science fiction and fact.
Yes, that's what John Campbell said.
When we're dealing with the surface of science.
And when you come to understand time, you can see why there's a lapse.
What age, how long did this man say that people lived on Venus? Did his account of Venus coincide, for example,
with
Howard?
I didn't discuss those things with this man. This man, when he came to my place, he came in the middle of a large meeting that we were holding. And there were 23 people in the room at the time he...
Yeah.
Disappeared and reappeared three times in front of us to show us how he could do it.
Mm-hmm.
I had 23 witnesses to that.
Yeah.
But he drove a Cadillac into the place. He had another man and two women with him. although none of the others ever spoke. They never said a word from the time they arrived or they left.
Of course, you're aware that appearance and reappearance, which doesn't necessarily imply a physical presence in a room, is something which a lot of Indian mystics are credited with being able to likewise do.
Yeah, but I've never seen one yet that could do it.
The
biggest bunch of fakers in this country are these people that claim they can do something.
Yes, but...
I've never found one yet that can do it, including these people who contend that they can contact the space people with infrared and solar red and infra-green and all kinds of,
you don't,
of gadgets. I've never seen one of them that could contact.
No, but I mean, this question of appearing and... appearing and disappearing in a room, for example.
Explain that very simply to you.
It's not
exactly how it is done. I know that when he was invisible, he was just as solid, and I could see him just the same as I could when I could see him.
He was quite solid.
He was still there, he was solid, and I could see him.
Did you want to ask a question?
Well, I was just going to ask George Van Tassel if he wasn't being just a little bit inconsistent when he... criticizes the people who claim contact through infrared rays or light beams or some of these other means of communication which have been pretty well advertised. If he denies the statements of these people,
I didn't deny them. I said I have never seen one of them yet perform for me. I've seen plenty of them come to my place with their gadgets, and when I ask them to show me, let's be at work, none of them have ever worked. They've never made a contact.
May I take a moment? I think you brought up the word gadget. I have a letter here from Howard E. Jensen, the chairman of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Duke University, located in Durham, North Carolina. I know that Dr. Jensen has listened to the program many times, and this is Jensen. I've received letters from them. This letter is not addressed to me. This is addressed to the gentleman you just met this evening, Jules St. Germain. And I thought in all fairness, you might want to comment on this as far as gadgets are concerned. The letter is addressed to Mr. Jules St. Germain, care of Long John, station WOR, New York, New York. Dear sir, last night my wife picked up the Long John program and heard your expose of George Van Tassel, Howard Menger, and others. I think Dr. Jensen is referring to the H.O. pictures that particular night. And he goes on to say, it seems to me that if, as my wife reports, Van Tassel is requesting aid for his rejuvenating experiment by holding out rejuvenation promises to Playboy millionaires on the grounds that he has already succeeded in rejuvenating work with lower organisms, he could and should be prosecuted by the postal authorities for using the mail to defraud. This movement would appear to be a gigantic hoax, which constitutes a great mental health menace to hundreds of thousands of persons, and on that ground alone should be under the close scrutiny of federal and state and legal authorities. I am not in favor of censorship of ideas, speech, and publication, no matter how fantastic, but where there are antisocial possibilities, as there seem to be in this movement, there should be legal action, prompt and vigorous, wherever the slightest legal evidence of using the mail to defraud can be shown. The final paragraph is personal.
Let me tell this gentleman that's listening, or the man that brought it, that I have never asked for any money from anybody for rejuvenation of anything. I have never asked for money anywhere at any time on this program, in any of my lectures, or any other time. I have been asked questions a number of times as to what it would cost for a particular building or a particular...
I think you mentioned that last time.
And I have answered what the approximate cost would be, but I have never requested at any time from anybody any money for anything. Any money that is donated for the work we're doing is donated by people who feel that we're doing something because they've come and investigated on their own and made a contribution toward anything we're doing. And like I say, we've got evidence we're doing something of a physical nature. We are not running around the country promoting money for anything.
No, the reason I like
promoting believers in flying saucers. Right. We don't care whether they believe or not.
George, the reason I bring this letter up is due to the fact that you've just been commenting on gadgets, such as green ray, red ray, infrared ray, and things like that. And you felt that possibly these things did not exist as far as methods of communicating with other planets because you've seen no evidence of it. In other words, no one has ever shown it to you. Now, is it true then that when people are interested in the possibilities of this machine, you showed me some photographs of three, I'll have to employ the same term, gadgets they're used, and they're put together, and they create this rejuvenating machine. Have you ever showed this machine, have you ever demonstrated this machine to the people who may be interested in it?
No, for the simple reason that this particular machine, if it passes a zero phasing stage, it'll disintegrate anything put into it.
Unfortunately, I do not understand that terminology. Could you explain that to me, please?
I can't explain it to you because I'm dealing with a science that our science knows nothing about. I'm not dealing with anything electronically, so I can't use electronic terms. I have to use the terms that fit the conditions. And this is not the rejuvenation thing. The thing I showed you the pictures of has nothing to do with the rejuvenation.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was a miniature machine.
No. The apparatus that was for the rejuvenation, I said, works on a primary energy principle.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the nearest we could come to it without building the cage device that's caged into the lines of force. This is the nearest we can do anything toward that line with what we call the Earth's magnetic field, which is a secondary energy.
I would like to point out at this point that this appears to be another case where a person is offering an opinion, a rather definite opinion, and in a rather impolite way about something that they admit they know absolutely nothing about. There's no evidence in this letter whatever that the writer of this letter has ever investigated any part. I perhaps shouldn't take part in this because it has nothing to do with me, but I can't help but point out the fact that this is another case where the writer obviously believes so strongly in his own opinion that he feels there's no necessity to supplement that opinion with any investigation.
Well, is the machine available for investigation?
May I see the letter again?
Yes, sure.
The letter is written with the intent of putting propaganda thoughts into people's minds to prosecute me as a mental hazard. That's what the letter is written for. It does that very thing. It suggests certain things should be done. This is the menace of the same people that are working behind security to take over this country.
Who are those people who are working to
How
take
do we
over
know
the country?
Who they are? They're hidden behind a word called security. So far as I can find out, I don't know who they are.
Well, but you are referring to them. You're implying that they are behind this attempt to...
No, I don't say they're behind this letter.
This is
equivalent, or this letter signed by Howard E. Jensen. This man has never come and talked to me. You don't know. Why should he even mention my name in a letter such as this without...
Because he's listening.
Without at least trying to find out who I am.
Well, he is a listener to the program.
But Mr. Montes,
now, he says this movement would appear to be a gigantic hoax. Now, it's only what appears to be a gigantic hoax. The only hoax on this program is the H.O. picture. They are confessed a hoax. I don't know of any other hoax. But this man implies that it seems to me that if, as my wife reports, now is he talking or is his wife reporting? Van Tassel is requesting aid for his rejuvenation experiment. Now, I don't know where he gets the idea I'm requesting aid. There's no status of any such request at all.
Pardon me a moment. Jules, would you just come over here a moment? Maybe you have more knowledge of
It says here that he has already succeeded in rejuvenating work with lower organisms. I didn't say I had succeeded in rejuvenating work with lower organisms.
Well, I think he was...
Yeah, he misunderstood.
He's referring, rather, to the lizard.
That's right. He could and should be prosecuted by the postal authorities for using the mail to defraud. Well, now, there he is suggesting something that he knows will be brought out over the air. Why should I be prosecuted by the postal authorities for using the mail to defraud? I'm not asking anybody for anything.
Well, in all fairness, I have never had the pleasure of talking with Dr. Jensen, and you know the letter is not addressed to me.
No, it's addressed to the man who performed the hoax, not to me.
Have you contacted Mr. Jensen since you've received this letter?
No, as a matter of fact, John, I just saw it.
Oh, just one of the letters that you just received?
That is right. I just saw it about 10 minutes ago for the first time. I thought it might be of interest in view of the fact that his opinions pretty well coincide with mine.
And where did he get these opinions? This program?
I cannot probe into this gentleman's mind, Mr. Van Tassel. I read on the air some months ago excerpts from your proceedings of the College of Universal Wisdom. And I think any normal thinking mind would interpret those statements of yours as a direct hit for fun.
I don't know whether there's anything other than on the second page, which is the page that tells who is responsible for the printing and so forth, other proceedings, it says something about funds for the research are essential to keep it going.
Well, as I understand, Mr. Van Tassel, you have a research laboratory being constructed.
We have a blueprint about printing, yes.
And your rejuvenating machine, I understand, is part of that.
It'll be in that building, yeah.
Well, could I refresh your recollection of some of your own words from...
Yes.
Well, just before you do, if you have something there that you want to look up, here's a bulletin from the WOR newsroom. The United States and her allies have nullified the 4-year-old Korean armistice agreement.
I might say, I think Mr. Van Tassel has very cleverly, if I may use that word, in his proceedings, avoided the word, please give me money. But his periodicals have been so phrased that there's implicit in the words that he uses a asking for funds. Now, just this quote from his proceedings. There's so much of this stuff here, it's hard for me to pick it out. July 1st, 1954. He refers to the College of Universal Wisdom, its purpose. Among the things, I'm quoting now, we've received data about are rejuvenation, extension of the human lifespan, electrical energy at no cost, light motors that require no fuel, the elimination of requirements for work through the application of free energy mechanisms, the elimination of disease from the earth, also the development of conoscopes, tensor scans, crystallographs, and other instruments used by the space people. With the perfection of any of these, through research, the means to make and use them will be advanced to the people without cost. The college research is to your benefit at no cost to humanity, except the free contributions you make voluntarily to make these things possible. That's a darn good commercial, in my opinion. Let me go
Let me answer that.
All right.
Let's be fair about this.
I certainly want to be.
All right. That is a statement of fact. There is no thing there. Naturally, anything you do today requires some money to do it.
Well, then you are asking for money, aren't you?
No, I'm not asking for it. I only stated it was necessary for the purpose.
And what is the invitation for people to contribute?
It only indicates I'm stating that money for the purpose is necessary. I didn't ask anything.
You are stating such facts as rejuvenation,
facts as longevity
of life. And if I might take a little exception with your calling those facts, permit me to. And then at the end, very subtly, Mr. Van Tassel, very subtly.
I know, you're a lawyer.
The college research is for your benefit. At no cost to humanity, except the free contributions you make voluntarily to make these things possible. I say again, sir, that is a pit and a clever pit.
Is that any different than a preacher asking for a little collection to maintain the church or anything that's required by contributions?
A moment ago you were saying you were asking for no contributions. Now you're drawing an analogy to the preacher.
No, I said that...
You're blowing hot and cold in the same breath.
I said that the contribution is necessary to maintain the research. We operate by contributions.
Then you are asking for contributions, aren't you? A moment ago you said you were not.
I don't think so. Could I interject?
Go ahead, Dan.
I think the statement here merely indicates that if there are no contributions, there can be no research.
That's right.
Now, I don't think this could be strictly implied as a request. It is, as you said, a statement of fact. If there are contributions, there can be research. If there are no contributions, there can't be
research. That's what
it is. This isn't a definite request to anyone to donate.
May I ask one question, Mr. Ventasso? In your proceedings, which, paraphrasing a remark of yours earlier, strangely enough, some of us don't see over here too often, in your proceedings, do you report regularly on these researches that you are conducting?
Do I report regularly?
Do you report on the research that you are conducting?
I report
in the college
anything.
With diagrams, details.
Of proving you. When we prove
anything of a proven nature?
Yeah, we're not going to
anything
print
of an
apparently
proven nature, you mean?
Stage of its operation.
Anything of an assumedly proven nature, you mean?
I mean that anything that we definitely know we can back up.
Would the rejuvenation of the lizards be an example of what
it
you can definitely...
rejuvenation of lizards.
Well, smashing the head in and then having the head grow back, is that the story?
The head doesn't grow back.
Have you photographs proving this?
I showed Long John some photographs. I haven't them with me tonight. It's only pictures of this small...
Well, I'll accept that. If you saw them,
why don't you tell us what you do with the lizard?
May I just a moment, please, Jules? It is very true that... I forget which morning it was at this point. I think it was Wednesday morning. George had a number of photographs here, and one group of photographs showed three, and you'll pardon me if I use this term, gadgets, the only way I can describe it.
Three pieces of equipment.
And he also had a 12-inch square next to it so that you can get a little idea of the size of these pieces of equipment. George also mentioned that they were not put together in their proper fashion so that anybody seeing the photographs would not know how this machine would function. Isn't that true? In other words, they were separated. But the only way I could say is if we wanted to show a lead pencil, you'd have some graphite and you'd have some wood over here, and you'd say, eventually I'll make something that I can write with.
Well,
when I put these together.
These were four pieces of equipment. Each one was built up out of
three.
No, there were four, and each one was built up out of other pieces.
I realize they were built up
pieces of equipment.
Yes.
Can I contribute a slightly skeptical note here? I'm a research worker in addition to being an editor. If you showed me these pictures... And on the back, there were notations by an independent witness saying that I testify, notarized notations, saying I testify that at 1:05 this was the physical appearance of the lizard. The next picture, I testified at 1:15. I testified at 1:25. I think I would be completely receptive.
These pictures were only taken to bring back here to show Long John.
Well, but you see, you can understand that in the absence of...
I have witnesses that have seen these things work. I don't need to write on the back of the picture.
Could you tell us the names of the witnesses?
That you should write. I'm suggesting the witnesses should write.
I haven't their addresses with me.
Uh-huh.
Well, could you tell us the name?
One of them's name is Darno.
Yes.
Two of his friends, who I don't recall their name because my association was not with them.
Are they the only witnesses?
No, there's several of their wives.
Any other men?
Wives.
The
yes, there's other people.
May I make this suggestion, George? for our listeners, because there are many nights that they're not with us on the program, and after all, we just started the program back in August, and we were only on the air for 2 or 3 months. That is the last time that you appeared on the program. I wonder if you'd be kind enough and just give us a brief outline of what happened on the desert when you found the two lizards with the crushed head.
What happened when I found them?
Well, you handled it any way
you
want.
Well, we didn't find them. In fact, most of this research was conducted by this man, Darnold. He was an associate.
Is that his last name?
Yes.
First name?
His last name. And the lizard head was smashed against a bench or table or something.
Was it done intentionally?
Yes.
To conduct the experiment?
It was done intentionally.
Well, don't mind me asking the question, George, because I'm not too familiar with the story at this point.
The only thing is that we found out in this research that if the time phase exceeded the differential of this field, that the lizard would completely disintegrate. And so we demonstrated again that the very forces which we can heat ourselves with can also burn us. And in other words, this particular field not only assembles the atomic structure of the head and makes it well again, but if you don't get him out of there in the right time, why, there won't be anything left of him. So we've held a lot of this information for that reason, because we're dealing with a force that's greater than atomic energy. It's prior to atomic energy, and even atoms are born from it.
Prior to atomic energy?
Yes, it's the force from which atoms are born.
Oh, I see.
Atoms from the beam.
Precisely what happens to the heads of this lizard, according to your story, sir?
Precisely what happens is that every atom is like a person. It's intelligent to a certain extent. It knows its purpose as an element. And as all of the people who left that lecture tonight knew their way home without having to ask anybody, when these atoms are dispersed in the crushing of the head, if they are permitted to be removed from all forces which tend to hold them apart, they will immediately reassemble themselves into what they would call home, or the last position they knew in relation to each other.
This is a quality, I believe, it's called plastic memory and formation.
Anyway, that's what takes place.
Yeah, well, the refusal to basic fundamentals, and to understand, so you're in, without two descriptive words, you smash in the head of a lizard, you put it under machine, according to your story, under certain conditions, and the head grows back to normal.
And the head grows back to normal.
Now, may I ask you, sir, how many witnesses you had to this? Actually,
well, I said 6 or 7. I don't recall right offhand. It might have been 8 or it might have been 12. I just can't recall exactly at the moment, because I can show anybody or take anybody to the witnesses out there, but I can't present them here.
Wasn't it true, George, if my memory serves me correctly, that during the time that you conducted this experiment with the lizards and the crushed heads and the rejuvenating machine, that there were two brain specialists there?
No. The two brain specialists only came into my place and told me about these brains they handled.
Well, as I must frankly admit to you, I could be wrong, but it seems that if my memory serves me correctly, that when you were with me last October, that you mentioned that there were two brain specialists at that time, and I also asked you the question if you knew the names, and they were from two major hospitals in the West Coast.
No.
May I ask this, Mr. Van?
Do
all these people come out from the West Coast, your witnesses, are you all out there?
Definitely, yes.
Yeah, well, I just want to remind you, your memory is very bad. I spoke to you at the Pythian Temple when you were lectured there. You told me the name of one of your witnesses was Smith from Chicago, another Wainwright from Indianapolis, but you couldn't give me the precise address.
No,
your story has changed, or your memory is very bad.
Story has changed because I don't know any Smith in Chicago.
I imagine there are. I know it's a very convenient name.
The only man I know in Chicago is Simons. You might have thought Simons and then turned it into Smith, because Simons is a man, not Smith.
Well, nobody. They're all from the West Coast, you just said a moment ago. Now we're in Chicago,
well,
and Indianapolis.
Well, these particular men are working on equivalent research, but they are not witnesses to the thing that I had.
Well, once again, sir, I say your story has changed, but you've been getting away from... you're getting away from the very basic issue. A moment again, you vehemently said you were not asking for contributions for the rejuvenation machine.
That's right.
Now you're justifying the contributions. Now, let me just quote again.
All right.
And once again, your language always tries to leave you a loophole. You tell that the property, you mention here, I don't want to read the whole thing about the rejuvenation machine. You say, after the building and apparatus are constructed, it will require at least a year of research to learn to control it actually on this planet. I intend to test it on myself first. The property, 10 acres, has been legally assigned to this organization by my wife and myself. Mm-hmm. We have piped water onto the property. The ground is surveyed. All that is needed now is the building and the apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
The building will cost approximately $26,000. More than this amount is spent continuously by people for things that bring no results. The apparatus will cost an additional $20,000 to $30,000. This is not any expenditure at all for such a benefit to humanity.
That's right.
Of course, you know there will be plenty of skeptics who have never done anything for anyone else but themselves who will ridicule all this.
Mm-hmm. There are.
The government can appropriate billions for weapons to destroy, so we do hope that they, the governmental authorities, will be interested in financing anything to prolong human life.
That's right.
We are not asking for anything. We do have, the two is underlined by you, by the way, the information to make rejuvenation possible, adding 50 to 80 years on the average lifespan, plus resumption of useful vitality. Think about it, some of you tired out millionaire playboys, and what a kick that is. You still don't want contributions, Mr. Van Tassel?
That is just a sarcastic remark on my part. That is not a plug for money.
Well, as a matter of fact, in every issue you ask for money, don't you?
No, I don't ask for money.
Contributions?
In the front, to the trustees of the organization and so forth, we are supported by contributions. We're the same as a church.
I think a lot of ministers might disagree with you, sir.
Well, you would disagree with me entirely. I don't know what your motive is in this whole thing, but
my motive is to protect people and to avoid fraud being perpetrated on the public, which is precisely why I am here tonight.
Why don't you come to Yucca Valley, California, and investigate out where the business is instead of back here?
Investigate.
Where you don't know what's going on.
I ask you, at the Pythian Temple, Mr. Van Tassel, refresh your recollection, would you be willing to demonstrate the rejuvenation of a lizard before disinterested newspaper reporters? And this was asked after you had been declaiming the press for the entire evening that failed to give you publicity.
I never condemned the press for not giving me publicity.
Well, let me finish, please. You said that it wouldn't prove anything. I wouldn't show this
to
newspaper reporters.
That's right, because they wouldn't know what they were seeing when they
saw
it.
But you would show it to me. Pardon me if I doubt your words, sir. I asked you if you'd show it to scientists. You said to me, what would that prove? It wouldn't prove anything.
What would it prove?
Showing it to me, would that prove something?
Nothing.
If there were one iota of truth in what you are saying, don't you think by the demonstration of these miraculously revived lizards, you'd have the world convinced? If any eminent, let me finish, please, sir. If any eminent, disinterested scientist saw this lizard's head grow back into shape, don't you think he'd say, this is a wonderful man?
Yeah.
Don't think your program would be sold? But
very
you
likely.
Show it to Smith or Wainwright
or that program, though.
But you want to benefit humanity.
That's right. That's
don't you think
I
the
do.
Government would be glad to help you, to finance you in this effort? Instead of asking for millionaire playboys to help you?
I didn't ask any millionaire playboys. Show me where it asks any millionaire playboys.
The implication is so clear, I will not split
here. Well, you're going by implication. That's your interpretation of it.
Well, Mr. Jensen heard me read this. He got the info. I don't know Mr. Jensen. I understand that he's a very well-known...
Dr. Jensen,
mm-hmm. sociologist.
And
I
anthropologist.
May I say one thing? Mr. Van Tassel has asked me why I'm here tonight. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I'm here is the remarks he made on Tuesday night, as you would say.
May I make this suggestion,
yes.
Jules, and I hope that you'll accept the suggestion. I mentioned to George when he came into town that I'd like to have him on one night with Jules. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he made the statement he saw no reason rehashing the H.O. letters. And this was his right as a guest. In turn, he made some comments because I brought up the question about H.O. letters. And in turn, as you know, you're in New York all the time. You can come on the program any night that you want. You happen to stop up here tonight with Ben over here just to say hello. This letter was handed to me. I read the letter, and then at the moment I became confused because I didn't know whether you had spoken to him. It's dated May 4th, and I thought that you could add some additional information. So, if you will, I don't think we want to talk
about
H.O. Not
information, accusation.
Well, we don't want to talk about H.O. letters. And
fine.
We don't want to talk about that he said this. He has an opinion of the H.O. letters, which he has a right to that opinion. I would like to have a discussion. You happen to be here now, and you're sitting down. I think that it would be of interest to George and to Dan and to our listeners to hear this discussed as two gentlemen, and I know that both of you are gentlemen. So he commented on what you were trying to accomplish with the H.O. letters, and we could take another 4 hours, and we'd accomplish nothing.
I don't want to belabor the point, John.
No, but you...
Let him have a moment, and then if I see fit, I'll stop him. Believe me, I will. Go ahead, Joe.
I don't want to belabor the H.O. letters. In and of themselves, I think they're rather insignificant. Their purpose was, number one, to show the gullibility of the persons with the will to believe, and secondly, that, in my opinion, Mr. Van Tassel was taking advantage of people. However, on the program the other night, there was a reference I made, which was made, comparing my method to Hitler. Now, that is something which I resented very much, one of the reasons I'm here tonight. Later on, a statement was made, and I'd like Mr. Van Tassel
to
explain it.
Well, I would like to also add, although you're welcome any night,
yes,
you were not invited here tonight to talk about that. You stopped up tonight, and this letter was presented to me, and I asked you to come in on this letter, right?
Yes, but do you think, John, that I, if the reference were made to your message as comparable to Hitler,
yes,
that you might feel a slight resentment?
Quite true, and don't you think that you're welcome to come on the program tonight?
Mr. Van Tassel commented that I made the statement in his absence. I much rather talk to him face-to-face, although there were three men there, Howard Mancher, Corcoran Hastings, and Mr. Lester were there to defend him that
and
night.
Mr. Sanderson.
That's
oh, well,
not to defend,
defend,
I don't
no,
think
he
exactly.
Was
he was
there.
Neutral.
Was neutral, that's right.
Now, Mr. Van Tassel stated this was done in his absence. Now, I don't like to do things in people's absence.
No,
I like to do what may I finish, please, sir? Face-to-face. At the end of the program, Mr. Van Tassel made the statement, referring to me, that he had better back off while he can, and I'd like to know precisely what he meant by that statement. I think I'm quoting verbatim.
I don't think I said that you better back off while you can.
Back off while he can, very
well,
definitely,
possibly
sir.
Possibly I did. I could have said such a thing. It sounded like me. The thing that I don't like is the fact that you have been on this show about 14 or 15 times, in which the tapes I have received, you have viciously attacked me. It seems to be your purpose to attack me personally. I don't know why, because there are dozens and dozens of researchers around the country operating on contributions, many of the great colleges...